Ms. De Leon.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Christine De Leon, a third-year law student at the University of Notre Dame, supervised by Mr. Robert Palmer. We have been appointed by this court to represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Tommy Ford. The court has asked us to address the issue of whether Wilsey v. State is a reasonable application of Supreme Court precedent. Your Honors, the Indiana Court of Appeals' use of Wilsey v. State was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court because it applied a rule different from the governing law in the case at hand. First, Doyle v. Ohio, the federal rule upon which the Supreme Court of Indiana applied when deciding Wilsey, is not the correct governing law to the case at hand. Second, the correct governing law is Griffin v. California, which speaks specifically to a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent during trial. And lastly, the application of the rule different from governing law warrants this court to grant the appellant's writ of habeas corpus. The Indiana Court of Appeals applied Wilsey when it denied the appellant's writ of habeas corpus. In Wilsey, the issue pertained to a 14th Amendment due process clause claim and specifically addressed the government's use of the defendant's post-Miranda statements and request for counsel. The Supreme Court of Indiana in Wilsey relied upon Doyle v. Ohio to determine that no constitutional error existed. In Doyle, the Supreme Court ruled that the state's use of the defendant's invocation of his post-Miranda right to silence as evidence of guilt was fundamentally unfair and thus a violation of the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. As this court stated in Savory v. Lane, the Doyle rule is predicated upon the implied promise of the Miranda warnings, which made it appropriate in the governing, or it made it the appropriate governing law in Wilsey. The facts in Wilsey and Doyle, however, are not applicable to the case at hand, where post-Miranda silence or statements were not at issue.
Well, as I read the Indiana Court of Appeals decision and then the decision of the Indiana Supreme Court, this Wilsey case that it relied on, and Doyle and Griffin, the court seems to misapprehend the source of the right in question in the particular iteration of the right, but it's sort of getting at the right principle, which is that there can be no comment on the defendant's invocation of the right to remain silent, either whether he doesn't testify or whether he does. It can't be used for impeachment purposes if he does testify. Those are the two sort of iterations of the no commenting on the defendant's invocation of the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and no argument about an inference to be drawn from that. So it was sort of in the right place in the doctrine, even though it wasn't exactly citing the right cases or citing the right source of the right. So can't we sort of generously read it that way?
Well, respectfully, no, Your Honor, because as this court stated again in Savory v. Lane, the Doyle standard or the Doyle rule is predicated upon the Miranda warnings and the implied promise in those warnings. Those warnings are not present in a situation such as Griffin or in the case at hand, where it is a refusal to testify at trial rather than an implied promise through the warnings and later the use of the silence to infer guilt.
Well, it all has to do with the right against self-incrimination and the invocation of the right being not fair game to comment on or instruct the jury on or argue about in terms of drawing inferences. So, you know, again, it all derives from the right against self-incrimination and these rules to enforce it in the course of a jury trial, whether the defendant testifies or not. So again, we're all sort of in the same constitutional area, and the operative question here is whether what the prosecutor said in his argument actually contravenes that principle, that you can't comment on it or invite the jury to draw a negative inference from it. So did the court get the principle wrong in application here, even though it cited the wrong source?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. It Again, when assessing Doyle versus Griffin, we have to look at the facts of each case. And in Doyle, the facts of the case were Miranda-based. Griffin specifically speaks to the facts in our case. And as this court differentiated in Savory versus Lane, because the defendant in that case did not testify at trial and the prosecutor did not use the silence to infer guilt or to impeach the defendant, Griffin applied and Doyle did not. So in that sense, yes, we have to go with Griffin as opposed to Doyle. And Griffin specifically states, or is the more specific rule, and the more specific rule should govern the more broad rule.
And how does what the prosecutor did here contravene the more specific rule?
It was not based on a post-Miranda silence. It was just based on the right to remain silent during trial. So his comments in relation to the defendant's failure to testify as opposed to remain silent post-Miranda.
Right, but they all derive from the same right against self-incrimination. The Miranda rule is a necessary prophylactic to protect the right against self-incrimination.
Right.
So a violation of it can't, or not a violation of it, but the prosecutor can't comment on an invocation of the right to remain silent after being Mirandized, and the prosecutor also can't comment on the defendant's continuation of an invocation of the right to remain silent by not testifying at trial. They're sort of two sides to the same coin. So let's focus on what the prosecutor said here and evaluate whether it violated that principle.
Okay. In this particular case, the prosecutor emphasized facts that only the defendant and the victim would know and stated specifically, quote, Essie Mae is dead, she can't testify.
But of course, the defense lawyer raised this question about motive, failure to prove motive, and the only one who would know motive would be the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. Although the opening the door to the questioning rather, or the argument regarding motive does not necessarily open the door to a fair response warranting a comment having to do with the defendant's right to remain silent during trial. That would just open the door to his specific instruction that it is not within his burden of proof to show that what the motive was. It was completely unnecessary, and the prosecutor's initiative to comment on the defendant's silence during trial.
I see you may be in your rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Miklos.
May it please the Court. The Indiana Court of Appeals appropriately applied the holding of Strickland in determining that trial counsel was not ineffective and that the state's comments did not rise to the level of a constitutional violation that would warrant a new trial had counsel objected. In adjudicating Ford's claim, the Court rested its decision on three reasonable factual findings. First, that the state commented on a defendant's right to remain silent and not Ford's silence specifically. Second, that the state's comments were made in response to defendant's argument that the state had failed to prove a motive to kill Hodge, the victim, and therefore it should not convict Ford. And three, the state's rebuttal did not urge or invite the jury to infer Ford's guilt or to otherwise consider in assessing Ford's credibility. These findings fully support the court's reasonable conclusion that the comments made by the prosecutor did not rise to a level of reversible constitutional violation.
The source of law that the court cited was clearly wrong, though.
The court cited two sources. One was Doyle, and one was the Fifth Amendment.
It cites Willsey.
It does cite Willsey, yes.
Isn't a good authority for the points you're making.
The state court cited both Doyle and Willsey. the references to Wilsey quote a particular body of law that speaks about that a comment on the right is not in and of itself a constitutional violation, and found that to be applicable to these to this incident, that even if the prosecutor spoke about or made a comment about the right to remain silent, that that in and of itself is not a violation, but yet we must look at the context of the in which the comments were made. And here, the defense counsel attacked not only the witness's credibility, generally speaking, their ability to point to Ford as the identity of the perpetrator, but also that there was absolutely no motive for Ford to kill Hodge or to kill Hodge under these circumstances. And so the prosecutor responded to, in essence, a challenge to the level or the sufficiency of the evidence of the state's case in arguing back that, first of all, motive is not necessary in order for the state to establish its case. But it prefaced its comments by saying that the state always has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty. But second of all, that the defendant always has the right to remain silent and does not have to say anything. These comments are focused towards the right to remain silent. It was not pointing to Ford's decision to remain silent. And that's very important in the court's analysis. But second of all, even if it was an indirect comment on silence, the prosecutor's argument did not encourage the jury to infer guilt, which is the danger that Griffin speaks to. It's the danger that Doyle speaks to. Both Doyle and Griffin are fundamentally rooted in the Fifth Amendment, but the court draws a line in that at trial, the right under Griffin is specifically derived directly from the Fifth Amendment. Before trial, it, for example, the cases following Doyle talk about the Miranda safeguards and that it's protecting a defendant's right against self-incrimination. And so the source pre-trial is more along the lines of a due process violation. We're not going to allow the defendant to be informed that he has a right to remain silent and then allow that to be used against him at trial. That cost would not be allowed. So the direct source, whether it's under Doyle or Griffin, all stems from the Fifth Amendment. There would be no Doyle but for the Fifth Amendment and the defendant's right against self-incrimination.
Well, and Doyle was before Dickinson, in which the court definitively said that the Miranda rule is required by the Fifth Amendment. So it may be that they were looking for some other source other than the Fifth Amendment for this no-comment rule.
Correct, Your Honor. There are also several other considerations which further support the state court's adjudication. One goes directly to the deficient performance, which was counsel decided not to raise an objection because of the prosecutor's prefacing comments on the right to remain silent. Second of all, which goes to both deficient performance and prejudice, is that the trial court's instructions to the jury, that it's the state's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that the arguments of counsel are not evidence, that Ford is not required to prove anything and maintains the presumption of innocence throughout the end of trial, and that the jury is not to consider in any way Ford's decision not to testify. And three, the evidence of guilt was overwhelming in this case, which further supports that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel. Ford was with Grace inside of his home just both immediately before and immediately after the shooting. Before the shooting, Ford said to Grace that he could not stand Hodge, who they had just seen on their way into the home, and he said that he would be right back. Immediately after the shooting, Ford reappeared to Grace and said he had to get out of here, and he wanted Grace to meet him in a back alley. And Grace could not account for Ford's whereabouts in between those two times, which was when Grace heard the shots of the gun. There were also two witnesses that specifically identified Ford as leaving the scene with a gun in his hand. One of those witnesses indicated that Ford made a gesture across his neck in a slashing motion. And there were two witnesses that described to the police a man who walked up to Hodge and just shot him in the head, and indeed the autopsy revealed that Hodge had died from a gunshot to the back of the head.
Well, the first trial ended in a hung jury.
Yes, Your
Honor. And there were some differences between the first and the second trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I recall, there were some absent witnesses, or at least an absent witness.
Correct. There were two. In looking at the Court of Appeals decision, there appears to be two witnesses, one of the sisters that observed Ford, and also another person who observed the shooting, who reported what he saw to the police. So they did not testify in person. But we do not know the actual differences other than those two things, between the first trial and the second trial, because the first trial was never reduced to a transcript. It was never entered into the adjudication or collateral review of this particular conviction. And so it is pure speculation. For all we know, the defendant challenged the state's case on the ability to present a motive and that they should acquit the jury, and that the prosecutor equally responded as they did here. We have absolutely no idea.
I thought some of one of the absent witnesses' testimony from the first trial was read to the jury, so part
yes,
of the trial was transcribed.
The sister's testimony, correct, was read to the jury. And the entire trial was not reduced to a transcript and entered into these proceedings, and so therefore Ford cannot use it as affirmative evidence that there was no prejudice.
Right, but it's a little bit of a stretch to call the evidence overwhelming when there was a hung jury the first time around, and fewer live witnesses in the second trial. Juries hang for all kinds of reasons. We don't know why, but
yes, and for that reason, I do disagree, Your Honor. And we have no idea what the effect of reading a witness's testimony into the record, as opposed to the jury being able to listen and observe the witness as they testimony, what kind of effect that has on the jury. And we don't know where the jury deadlocked.
Some people read better than they sound.
Yes, absolutely.
Not,
and we don't.
Not the lawyers in this case.
I'm sorry?
Not the lawyers in this case.
That's right. But we don't know what the deadlock was. We don't know if it was 11-1, one way or the other. So we have, it's only pure speculation, which is not enough to show beyond a reasonable possibility of a different outcome.
Well, the defense attorney kind of recited that he thought he did a great job in cross-examining her. I guess she was pregnant at the time.
Yes, at the second trial,
sister
was pregnant
the baby
and breastfeeding.
And couldn't show up.
Yes,
and he was real happy about that because he thought she would be a lot better prepared the second time.
Yes,
a little bit speculative, but that's at least what he said.
Yes, and that's why he did not object to her testimony being read to the jury.
Yeah.
If there are no further questions, Your Honors, the state asks you to affirm the district court in the denial of the writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Ms. DeLeon, you've got 2 minutes left.
As Your Honor has pointed out, there were two trials here, the first ending in a hung jury and the second ending in Mr. Ford's conviction. One of the differences here is that is the prosecutor's statement during closing arguments, which were, quote, "Sometimes we'll never know why crimes were committed. Someone who could, now let me phrase this correctly, he never has to say a single word. It's the state's burden to prove that he committed this crime beyond a reasonable doubt, but what happens when you have crimes, when you have one or two people there who can possibly talk and tell you what happened, and one of them's dead. Who else are we going to get that information from? The next possible source is the person who committed the offense. If that person who committed the offense don't talk, how would we ever know? Given the totality of his statement, despite his one sentence stating that he doesn't have to say a single word, it doesn't negate the fact that he commented on the defendant's refusal to take the stand during trial. Also, his statements saying, now let me phrase this correctly, could infer that he knew what he was about to say was something that he probably shouldn't say.
Well, maybe he was just trying to be very careful not to cross the Griffin line and actually invite the jury to make an inference.
Correct, Your
which
Honor.
Which would be the prohibited kind of comment.
Correct, Your Honor, and something like that is admittedly difficult to see or to infer from the cold record, but what we do know is that he did make a comment in reference to the defendant's refusal to take the stand, a comment that was unnecessary and not a fair response to the motive. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Ms. De Leon, the court thanks you for your efforts on behalf of your client and thanks Notre Dame Law School for participation in this program.